Hey, everybody. This show is brought to you by OGRacing.com. Check out our buddies over at OG Racing if you're looking for anything from helmets to suits to all the safety gear that you need for your car and for yourself to get on track safely this season. Johnny from OG has been on the show a bunch of times, good friend of the show, and a NASA TT racer. He's just one of the many staff, super helpful people over there at OG, and we really appreciate them supporting the show. So check them out at OGRacing.com. Any questions at all about anything they sell or anything that they recommend, give them a call. 1-800-934-9112, and free shipping on orders over $100. So check out OGRacing.com, 800-934-9112. Show's also brought to you by GridLife. Check out the May 5 event we have coming up. Go to grid.life, scroll down, and go to May 5, the Shakedown event up at Road America, our first time there. We had a really, really good kickoff event of the year at Mid-Ohio last weekend, and super super well attended. Really, really fun. A lot of good competitive racing. Check out the website grid.life, and you'll see all the info about our May 5 event. Registration is $270 prior to April 1, $285 post April 1, and it is in conjunction with World Racing League. They'll have a session also on track, and they'll be doing checkout rides to see if you're eligible for a World Racing League license. So if you intend to race with them, check that out. And mainly, it is an intermediate and advanced track day only. No beginners. So if you're looking for good quality track time, go sign up. We'd love to have you guys out there. May 5, Friday. Really reasonable price for Road America for a day. So hope you guys can join us. And on with the show.
Welcome, everybody, to Slip Angle Show. I'm Austin Cabot.
I'm Adam Jibay.
And we are at Mid-Ohio.
We are.
For Track Battle Round 1, GridLife.
It's my favorite track to drive on. It's a little hard to host an event here today. They didn't have internet.
I mean, and it's our first time here.
And the gas pumps didn't work. And we didn't know where grid was because they wouldn't let us use false grid.
I didn't even know where the classroom was.
They didn't give us a classroom because they had it for something else. It's been frustrating, but it's been okay.
It's okay.
Track was awesome. I'll give them one thing. The workers on track and, like, the safety crew, they're pretty pro. They did a great job.
They're professionals, man.
Yeah, they were similar.
Especially this early in the season. Like, they are on their game.
Yes, they were similar to Road Atlanta. We're talking like 30-second poles. Like, they got trucks in different spots. Like, that makes me happy.
Yeah.
A few cars found the wall, but I think everything's still rolling.
I think it was only two maybe?
Yeah, one light tap, and then that Mustang from Atlanta kind of like, whoop!
Oops.
Whole side of it.
Oops.
Big 3-inch toe in. But overall, pretty good day so far.
Yeah.
We had to end early because NASCAR was doing safety testing and training and stuff. So
I thought they were going to be doing actual like NASCAR testing. Is what I was under the impression.
Way more
of.
Awesome.
Yeah, there'd be like loud NASCARs
There's
going by
just
in
like
the back.
50 people in red suits walking around.
Dang it!
It's not cool at all.
Somebody should go up to them and like run away from them and go, "The red coats are coming! The red coats are coming!" Be kind of funny.
It's pretty nerdy, dude.
Whatever.
Pretty inside nerdy. I love it.
But we have a local with us right now.
And we've mentioned him on the show a few times. He's somebody that's raced against like friends of ours, us. I technically raced against you at VIR, I think.
That's true. Yeah. 13 hour.
Yeah, we've got Mr. Jeremy Lucas on the show, who we've been trying to record with probably for the last year.
Like on and off. We're like, hey, you want to do a show?
Yeah.
Sure. Whatever.
Yeah. Whatever you guys want.
I keep getting messages when people who listen to your show on time hear me, but like I listen to them like, you know, a month later or whatever, because I'll do, you know, a month's worth and at an odd time and I'll run out and then I'll forget for a month and then go back and listen to a month's worth driving into work in the morning.
Well, we apologize about that because it's just unbelievable levels of mediocrity, but we appreciate your support.
No problem. So,
I first time I ever met you was on the phone when I bought an AIM Solo from you.
That's right.
Because you have a little company that is, what, Fastech Limited?
Fastech Limited.
Yeah. Is that you?
Yes.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
I have a couple people that work with me for like different areas of the country. Like, whether you know it or not, the Greg Amee.
Oh, really?
Is kind
PGA,
of my East Coast representative. So if somebody needs help with data coaching out in that area, in the Northeast area, Greg is my go-to guy to send them to. And then I have a guy out in St. Louis. His name is Dave Jones. It's Good Times with Dave is his website, and he does track setup. He does track setup work as well as data coaching.
Okay, yeah.
So kind of, you know,
does that he way do we birthday parties? Because that's that's a cool name for a website.
But he's done a lot of runoffs level prep for people.
Okay,
and Dave's a good guy. He's really good with suspensions.
Okay,
Where I'm not so great with suspension work because. Yeah. I grew into racing just doing non-adjustable. Like, my first race car was a Schramm stock car.
Oh, cool.
And yeah. Literally all you can adjust is tire pressure. Yeah. So you have, you know, normal tire pressure up front, 45 PSI in the back.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it takes to make
a front-wheel drive car.
I think the only other thing you could adjust is the million little cheats that those crazy Schramm stock guys found over many years.
That never happens. I don't know where you heard these stories
never,
from.
Never, ever.
There's so many stories.
You know, it just happens to be that, you know, cars have damage from curbs.
Yeah.
You know, that just happens. Wow,
got like
over
3 degrees of camber
over
there
the life
from
of a car.
Damage.
Man, that looks like a stock knuckle to me, but there's so many stories of people just
It just requires
those
cars. An OEM part. That's all it says, OEM. Yeah.
And if it's OEM and also crashed into curbs to bend.
You know, actually, though, they did have, there were camber specs.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, just some of the, I think some of the manufacturers were a little bit more creative about the numbers they published.
Okay.
In terms
it had
of,
to be within a range.
Right. Right. So, but then, like, I never saw this personally, but I've heard stories of manufacturers publishing, like, service bulletins saying that, you know, post-crash cars, this
can
was
be.
An acceptable range.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's
so
awesome.
That's how
somebody
you go from
a guy, huh?
That's how you go from a, you know, a car where it says, you know, max camber is
yeah.
one degree,
yeah.
And all of a sudden 2.5 is okay.
And then all of a sudden the neon's winning everything.
That's right.
Or whatever.
They're in cahoots, man.
Yeah,
they're all in cahoots.
You just got to know the right guy at the manufacturer, huh?
So now, meanwhile, like, after cars have gotten wrecked, the body shops are like, oh, 2.5 degrees of camber, okay.
Yeah,
so there's all these, like, normal stock cars rolling around.
Yeah, that's 2.5 degrees of camber. Thing that actually happened because of stupid showroom stock racing.
Probably.
Well, how did you get into wheel-to-wheel stuff?
Well, I was kind of a motorcycle guy originally.
Okay. Oh, really?
And I was helping a race team work on their bike stuff, and that's how I didn't grow up doing mechanical stuff. My dad was not mechanical. He didn't work on his own cars. He had some nice cars when I was a kid, and but we never did anything. Like, it was take it to the shop and they fix it. So mm-hmm. It wasn't until I got into bikes and working with the race team that I actually started doing mechanical stuff. And that's why I got into it in the first place, is because I just liked working on stuff. I found that I liked it. But I found that I was not cut out to be a motorcycle racer. So four wheels beckoned for racing.
Yeah. You wanted to have things
yes,
around you.
Yes, yes. And so I started racing cars.
How far did you get with doing track days and motorcycle stuff?
I probably did about a half dozen track days and motorcycle mm-hmm. stuff. I used to ride fairly frequently. Before I started racing, we would probably go out every other weekend.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And here in Southeast Ohio, there's a lot of good riding, which is about 2 hours from Columbus to get to the good roads. So we would literally meet somewhere for breakfast, a group of us, ride Southeast till lunch, find somewhere to eat lunch, and ride back a different way. And that's the kind of riding I used to do.
Okay.
I didn't commute on bikes. I didn't go to the store on bikes. You know,
it's
didn't
like
go to work on
touring
bikes.
Weekend touring rides. And
weekend stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We used to do about 10,000 miles
a
season.
What were you riding?
I've had several, but my favorite would have to be the VFR 750.
Okay. Yeah, I had a VFR 800. And
yeah.
Those things, just the
Earlier
V4s.
Late, did you have the gear
was
driven
it 2000?
Cams? So then you still have the gear driven cams.
Yep.
Yeah, the gear driven cams.
No VTEC.
That is the best
amazing.
Thing ever.
That's got VTEC bikes that rules.
Yeah, the VTEC 2002.
Yeah,
first year. I think the VFR 800 was the first bike with VTEC.
But I think when they went to VTEC, they lost the gear driven cams, right?
Yeah,
it went to a
yeah,
belt.
It went to belt.
But okay. The unique sound of the gear driven cams on the V4.
Does it sound kind of like a whining awesome. Supercharger or something? Or?
A little
no.
bit. Yeah. There's a little bit of a whine to it. Not
with an
not
exhaust,
high pitch, though.
Yeah.
With an exhaust, though, the V4s just sounds so mean.
It does.
V4?
Yeah.
I literally don't know anything about
it's
bikes.
It's a V4.
It was kind of like the best of everything. Like, V-twins tend to be yeah. really torquey but kind of slow to rev, where the V4 didn't have that problem. And then also had a really unique sound to it.
Yeah.
Really flexible motor.
Interesting.
It's just a great bike. Single-sided swing arm, which was way cool back in the 90s. I think it was 97 or something
yeah.
like that. But
yeah, that would have been the last year for the 750, because 98 they went to the 800.
I sold my last bike when I did like less than 200 miles in 1 year. It's like,
oh man,
you see, you don't have bikes anymore.
Yeah, I still have my gear. I was like, you know, maybe someday I'll get another one. But
yeah,
my replacement for motorcycles has been convertibles.
Okay,
oh cool.
It's funny. That's how the S2000 was like written up in some magazines. It was a four-wheel motorcycle.
Yeah. So I remember interesting. Some of those articles when they came out in 2001 or whatever. How many cars do you have? You have a bunch of street cars and stuff. Kind of a car collector of sorts now.
I always have to think twice, make sure I think it's seven. My wife has a new Civic street car. I have an old BMW wagon, winter beater, dog transporter car.
It's not old, man.
It's 2001.
That's an E46. It's still very modern.
That'd be the newest thing I own except my work truck.
Well, exactly. But everything else is pretty much older. So a 944 S2.
Okay.
A mid-80s BMW 535. This one's actually kind of special because it's a M535 IS. Oh. And it's a Euro import.
Okay.
So it's...
Back in the 80s, they had so many cool Euro imports.
It's got the center exit exhaust, right?
Yep, center exit exhaust.
Yeah, those things are rad.
So that's kind of the...
What motor's in those?
The Euro ones. It's a 3.5-liter straight six. Yeah. It's real torquey. Yeah.
You saw the one that's competing in Time Attack, right?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing sounds so great.
Yeah, it's really
Charlie
cool.
Charlie Anselin's. Yeah. It's so cool. The Hard Times one. It's got a swapped motor. I forget what motor it had. It's a bigger motor, I think.
Yeah.
Charlie listens to the show, and he'll probably send me a Facebook message as soon as we publish this.
But, you know, once I started racing cars for the street, new cars kind of got really boring.
Yeah.
Because basically I have this, like, theory on cars that you either have to have for a street car, you need a car you can just, like, flog, like, 110%, mm-hmm. or you need something that has power on demand oversteer. Mm-hmm. Right, so like
I can see that. Yeah,
anything between 150 horsepower and 400 horsepower, it just kind of meh.
Yeah, so you want sub 150 or over 400?
Yeah, that's right. So I used to have a Corvette Z06 street car. Okay. I used to do a lot of instructing with it.
Yeah,
and you know that car, power on demand oversteer. You could always put a smile on your face, but like you know when I had an S2000, it's a fast car, right? But to have fun on the street. You have to just be going so far.
You got
to
push it a lot.
Whereas, like, now I'm back to a Miata again for my convertible. And, you know, best setup ever is my 185 snow tires.
Really? Just enough, huh?
Oh, it's just enough, and you can get the car to rotate. You know, you can actually get when you, you know, what, 105 wheel horsepower, whatever it is, right? It's an NA. So, yeah, we can actually get some rotation out of the car just from that power with that kind of tire. But people put, like, you know, big, huge, sticky tires. That's fine if you want to go fast. But if you want to have fun on the street, for me, the car's got to move around a little bit.
Seems like you have a pretty cool commute. You post some pictures on Facebook of like
it's like backcountry roads.
It's all back roads,
around here, right, kind of?
Yeah, it's basically the same, like, what you have to do, get from the highway to here.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of roads.
We found this cool road in the middle of the night last night with Abram, our tech inspector.
Down by the, like, literally we like, down by the river.
This is awesome. I need to come back here in the middle of the day.
But, I feel really lucky to have that kind of commute because... Yeah. I do not think I would do well with my wife's commute. She commutes downtown or
just straight down the highway.
Her folks are out in California. She's out in LA a lot. And I think I would go postal with that kind of commute.
I don't have any kind of cool commute. I walk two blocks to my truck and then I slave away in a pickup truck driving around city. It's terrible. I would love to cruise like from here to the hotel.
Yeah.
Like every day if I could do that, find like one of five routes. Oh, that'd be so fun.
Sound like Mike Taylor now.
That'd be so great.
It's great for convertibles because you don't have to worry about trucks and people throwing rocks up in the air and come down hitting you on the head and stuff.
That's true. Yeah, you know.
I had a friend get beamed once with a rock in the forehead.
I saw some kids throwing rocks onto the highway the other day in Chicago, and I pulled over and I said, "You're going to kill someone. I'm calling the cops." And they ran away.
Wow.
But they were throwing rocks onto the highway off of an overpass.
Jeez.
Like, how stupid is that? I didn't know that was a thing that happened. It blew my mind.
You see it on the news every once in a while. Yeah. I mean, people have been killed.
Yeah. I remember somebody got killed in the town next to mine. Somebody dropped a boulder onto him off the highway and killed, and it took out like three cars crashing. But highway commutes kind of sucked.
Yeah. We were talking yesterday about people doing that at some of the Hyperfest events, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I remember that. At some point, there were stories of people throwing beer bottles and stuff.
Drunk patrons.
I was there the year that Todd went up into the trees.
Yeah, I have the trans that... Xavier Caldone like rolled a million times with and the front mount's all broken off. That's the case I have going to my next car.
Oh really?
Yeah, I bought the trans.
Nice.
I bought the trans at the VAR 13 hour I met you in person at.
Yep. I like that track layout. Although I don't think it's so safe to go off track.
Yeah. No.
Seems like every car that goes off there
just
rolls or
bad problems.
It's a tree or
I've never been to that track. I've watched a bunch of in-car video and we were talking about
the layout's fun.
It looks ridiculously
fun.
Yeah,
like Abram,
the layout is really fun.
Somebody, it wasn't Abram showing us video, it was somebody else. I forget who.
Yeah, just the other day.
But yeah, accidents tend to be really bad.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that place is very forgiving.
Yeah.
No. Kind of Road Atlanta-esque as far as if you go off, there's a 50-50 chance something's happening. But
yeah, but you usually don't roll when you go off at Road Atlanta.
No, you just slide into something hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been there, done that.
Real hard.
You race long enough, you're going to find a wall at Road Atlanta.
Which wall have you found there?
Have
you listened to the one with Bowie Gray where he basically crashed at every turn? That's a good show.
Yeah, that's from Grid Life last year.
It's a good show.
I probably have heard it. I just can't remember it.
Yeah, Bowie crashed like 7 cars there.
Oh, yeah, I know. That's where I met him. I met him at Road Atlanta. So I always ask him for any type of advice for Road Atlanta or to refresh my memory.
Yeah,
or
where have you hit there?
I think it was the outside of 3.
Okay.
The right-hander?
Yeah, up at the top of the hill.
I was tucked up behind a 944 and went over the curb with him.
Yeah.
And I couldn't see the curb before I went over, and it hooked the rear tire.
Mm. Oh, okay. And hooked it wrong.
It caught the rear tire and hooked me right in. Yeah. It was in the Speccy 30.
Okay.
The same car you still have?
Yep.
Yeah, so right now
we had to do a little, tow vehicle front bumper pull action.
Yeah, tied to something. Are you ready?
Yeah, I think we used somebody else's truck, so it was like between 2 trucks.
Like the
we are in Georgia. That's a Georgia frame machine at a collision shop.
Drawing quarter that thing, baby.
the Speccy 30 guys down in the southeast. There's a huge group of
these guys
them.
Are great,
and
they really are.
I didn't realize at first, but I broke the trans mounts.
Okay,
really.
And luckily, somebody else, another Speccy 30 guy, had the parts, offered them up, kept racing.
The only time I've raced there with NASA was, and there was like a ton of Speccy 30s and PTD cars and stuff, like all E30s.
Yeah,
I must have been 10 or 15 of them in the group, and they were having a great time. They're all within like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
They're all fixing each other's cars.
I've been racing for about 18 years, and the Speccy 30 guys and the Honda Challenger guys have been the two most fun groups to race with. And coincidentally, that's what I do now, right?
Yeah.
I've migrated away from doing the SCCA Nationals, now called Majors.
Yeah.
Because, you know people and you have a few friends, but it's not the same.
It's pretty serious.
You know what I mean?
There's people really trying
Nationals
hard.
Majors, they get serious business stuff. Just
it's
like
almost
not
like I had fun at the Road Atlanta Majors, which is the only majors I've ever raced.
Yeah.
It was last year, but like it's so like the vibe was very serious.
But you already knew a lot of people coming into
that's
it too.
The thing.
Imagine you came into that and didn't know anybody.
No, it'd be very unwelcoming.
You wouldn't. No one would come and befriend you.
Yeah. No,
and I'm not saying it's always that way.
We paddocked up on the shelf, inside, and like we just had like 10 of our buddies there. It was all road race autocross guys.
But it's just not the same. Environment.
Yeah. It's almost like semi-pro level lately.
I have preferred the environment of the group in Speccy 30 and Honda Challenge. It's much more family-like.
Yep.
Everybody paddocks together. Everybody eats dinner together.
I'm planning on racing a couple of Honda Challenges this summer.
You better come to Pit Race. That's going to be a big one.
That does look like fun. When is that?
May sometime, I think.
That
I can check the calendar.
That track looks so great.
I haven't run the new expanded track yet.
Yeah, it looks so cool.
So they just expanded it last year, and I didn't get a chance to go back.
Is that the same owners now as VIR?
I think
it's the same owners.
Really?
I think it's the same.
I heard
group.
It was some like pet store company.
Maybe I'm wrong, but yeah, they put a lot of money in that place.
They did, yeah. But I forget. Somebody told me what chain of pet stores.
Someone
they
from like Petco or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those. Okay. I believe that bought it and dumped the money and finally got the second half of the
maybe
track built.
Wonder if that guy's an animal on Trek.
Oh no, the puns start already. I was wondering how long that was going to take.
They got pretty bad last night.
They did. We weren't recording really them, bad. But it was bad. And we did have some puns on the show from the road.
Yeah.
The one thing about Pit Race before was like it's like a sub 1 minute
lap
time.
It was Beaver Run, too. That was what it was called before.
Yep. So,
it was that small? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. It was like sub 1 minute lap time.
Oh, wow. That's tiny.
So,
that's really tiny.
Don't ever run an Enduro on the short track.
Yeah?
Because you'll be tired for about 30 minutes.
Just over and over and over.
Because
and over
it's so short.
Yeah.
You can't really, it's like, yeah, you just go nuts.
Yeah. But how big is it now? Do you know how big that track is now?
I think it's almost 3 times as big.
I was going to say it's like 4 miles or something, right?
Wow.
3 something, I think. But the new track is, I think, almost twice as long as the old track. Yeah. And you put it all together and it's almost 3 times as long.
My brother, who just walked into the RV here, him and his wife.
I was wondering who that stranger was.
His wife went to college out right by Beaver Run when it was called Beaver Run. And he said there's a crazy toad to get into that place.
Well, I don't,
like it's a
depends
crazy
if you
steep
try,
road.
Yeah, if you try and go the back way, there are some pretty steep ones,
and he's been
the actual road to go in is pretty steep.
Yeah,
but
he said people get like have problems climbing it.
What's crazy is you need to get off the interstate before you get to the exit, because like the last 10 miles, you get charged like $15
on the toll road.
Toll.
Huh.
So yeah, like as soon as you get in Pennsylvania, you have to get off and just take the back road, and it takes you like 5 minutes longer, and you avoid like the $15.
That's a big penalty.
They charge you for every axle and
We would have spent like $75 if we did toll roll.
Even just a car is expensive.
Yeah,
and then when you have a a truck and a trailer, it's really pricey.
It really adds up per axle. Yep. Yeah. We would have spent probably $75-$80 if we took the toll road to here.
Yeah, through Ohio.
And I guess it's all tore up, and there's cops wanting to give you tickets for like looking weird. It's bad, I guess. Like, my dad took it the other day. But.
The one thing I remember being really strange about Pit Race, at least the old track, and they've repaved it, so maybe it's different now, but it's the only track I've ever been to where the rain line is exactly the same as the dry line.
Really?
No change.
I wonder if that's where the new pavement, too.
It's not glossy or anything?
No. Nope.
Really?
Nope. Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it probably has one of the best grip track in the wet that I've ever been on. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you'd think normally there's quite a bit of drop-off on times, but, like, the top guys were running, like, I don't know, like 6 seconds slower.
Wow.
In the rain, like full rain.
Is it just that, like, porous?
That's
the water, like, drains down into it?
It must be.
Is it hard on tires or no? Or
was it? No, only the last turn.
Yeah.
Because the last turn is this big, long, sweeping uphill left after the fast straight. So you tend to really plow into it pretty fast and can really overwork that outside tire. But
I'm surprised the track would have the same rain line.
I've never been on a track where the rain
Autobahn
line's the same.
Is like totally different rain line.
Yeah.
Because it pools and it's glossy and polished because people are on it every day, all day.
Yeah. That's kind of more the typical situation.
So what do you race now? And you said you raced 18 years. You went from what, showroom stock?
From showroom stock to SCCA touring. I did a little improved touring.
Who are you running in those classes? What cars?
Touring was S2000.
Okay.
Back in the early days of touring for the S2000, I was actually involved with SCCA back then and helped get Touring 3 created as a class.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because back then it was only Touring 1 and Touring 2.
Okay.
And so I was part of the group of people that helped work on the rules to help.
It was like S2000, Z3s, RX-8s.
That went into T3?
Yeah, and T3,
yes.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Because they were lumped in with T2, and it wasn't really... I don't want to say they weren't competitive, but it was definitely like there was kind of like an A and a B group within T2. And then, like new cars would come out with more power and they would put them in T2. And like the scope of T2 just kept creeping up. Whereas like, an S2000 and an RX-8 were the same car from beginning to end.
Yeah.
They weren't changing. So they really needed to be in, now it's T1, 2, 3, and 4.
Right.
So they've kind of migrated over the years to that, but.
Remember, because at the time, I just bought my S2000, so I was looking at, classes that you could prep it to race in.
Well,
and I'd seen T3, and I watched some videos from T3, and it looked like the racing was so tight. I saw a couple starts, and like the first couple laps, it was really close.
And actually, back in that time frame is when we worked with NASA to get the S2000
into
H2.
Yeah.
So basically, at that time, when that first started, it was a complete crossover car.
Yeah, same weight,
same trim,
shocks,
same everything. So the rules were the same, whether you raced the S2000 in Touring 3 or whether you raced it in H2. And that was kind of the idea, is there was a bunch of cars racing in T3 to get them to come over and race in Honda Challenge H2.
Okay.
And it worked really well. I mean, the car still is competitive in H2. It does. There are cars that are faster, but the S2000 kind of is... consistent all the way through a stint. Basically, you're running the same lap time at the beginning of the stint as you are at the end of the stint.
Huh.
So usually a couple like the Integras and stuff, they'll run away. And it's just a matter of keeping on it to catch them at the end.
So for the S2000, what are the prep differences now between, I guess T3 doesn't really... Well, between T3 and T2.
I honestly don't know the T2 rules today.
Okay. They change all the time.
Yeah, they've changed quite a bit. And I've basically been out of racing SCCA Touring for probably about 5 or 6 years now.
Okay.
Back then, it was SCCA Majors didn't exist. It was SCCA Nationals. So now it's called Majors Program, which Adam knows all about. It's a little different. But I think now, back then, you had to run stock springs. So we were running the stock CR.
You run the CR, I was going to say. CR
so,
springs and shocks were open though, right? I know a lot of guys were running like TTXs on the high dollar builds.
Yeah, I saw a lot different things.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of guys getting themselves in trouble with adjustable suspension because they
didn't know
what they
it?
Were doing
yeah.
or didn't have the crew I did run doubles 1 year, and I found that to really do it effectively, you need a crew guy to be able to come in during qualifying or during practice, make an adjustment, and go right back out. Mm-hmm. Because trying to make adjustments between sessions, the track would change or other things would change, mm-hmm. and it was really hard to get them dialed in. But, man, when you got some good doubles on there, can you make the car behave wildly different?
I believe that.
You can just, you know, the front end's pushing, skating, whatever. You can just change all that behavior, and it was really impressive. But I think to make the most of it, you need a crew guy.
Yeah.
To make those changes, you know, mid-session so you can dial it in.
So how'd you go from, like, T3 up to Spec E30?
Yeah, Spec E30 is a very minimal prep class.
It is. At that time, I was doing a lot of instructing with the Z06, and it got to the point where I didn't want to be going 145 miles an hour down the back straight in Ohio without a cage.
Yeah, you'd be going fast there.
So, you know, I'd seen enough incidents and whatnot at that point to know that it didn't really have to be your fault to have something go wrong. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get something that was caged. And I was actually looking at a Spec Miata to convert from using the Z06 into a caged car.
Okay.
And I had a couple buddies at that time, Kyle and Sean, who were also instructing with me. They had Integra Type R's, mm-hmm. and they were thinking about going racing. And so I said, well, I'm going to buy a caged car, guys. Do you want to make the leap or whatnot? So
yeah,
we actually started off.
Thing, huh?
We actually started off in that car together.
Okay.
The three of us split it at first.
Probably a good way to do
the
it.
The same car you have now.
The same car we have now.
Oh,
but it's just me now. So here's the reason why we ended up in Spec E30. Sean is 6'4" on a low day. Right? And Kyle's
gravity's extra high.
I don't know what Kyle is, maybe 5'9", and I'm 6 foot, right? So we had a pretty wide range of drivers.
Yeah, 4 inches.
And that wasn't gonna work for a Spec Miata.
Right.
You can be a 6'4" guy and make a Spec Miata work for you, but it isn't gonna work for anybody else. Mm-hmm. You have to, you know, build the seat directly to the floor, maybe lower the floor, that kind of stuff. So we needed a car that was had some adjustability to it and could fit all of us. And we all kind of had BMW street cars and liked BMWs, and we liked the idea of a spec class because none of us were, you know, very budgeted to want to spend a lot of money on all the latest GoFast parts.
What year was this? You guys got that car?
I think it was about 6 years ago.
Okay.
Yep. And we
so Spec E30 was already a pretty large class.
It was pretty established. Yeah.
That's about a 10-year-old class now.
I don't know when it started.
So 6 years ago. That's when Mike Skeen was still racing.
Yep. I've raced with Mike here at Mid-Ohio. So that car was kind of something that could fit us all. And we just kind of started talking about it and watching the for sale ads and stuff. And this one ad popped up, and the car looked really good. And there's a cage builder here in Ohio that a lot of people know. His name is Mark McMahon.
Roll cage
guy.com or something like that. Yeah. All he does is roll cages.
Beautiful work.
And not only does he do beautiful work, he is one of the most affordable cage guys.
Yeah.
If you look at one of his cages that's, say, like a $2,600 basic cage, I think that's about where they are now. You go to anywhere else, that's a $3,600 cage easy.
Yeah. He did Rob. I think he did Rob Oxford's cage in his
S2000. Yeah. He's just really good at it. He doesn't do other stuff. He doesn't work on cars.
Yeah.
Just cages. He's got it down. He's got a method.
Yeah.
He's got an inexpensive shop that he works out of. It's out of a basement of like a printing house.
Yeah.
That's when you're like, where am I going? Like, it says like printing something, but
that's
anyway,
the dude. Yeah.
He's the guy.
Yeah, know the
he's
guy.
The man. And so this car, even though the guy was from Oklahoma, he had a McMahon cage in the car.
Wow.
And we thought if we bought a car, we were going to get a McMahon cage. And I just kind of chat with the guy, you know, kind of not too serious with him. He's like, oh, I'm going to be at Mid-Ohio. I'm coming up to the BMW Club event. Like, oh, well. We should at least go look at it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we go up and we look at the car. It was like a rainy October day or whatever. Car was stupid clean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can. There's parts of the cage where I can't even put a zip tie between the cage and the body.
It's pretty tight, huh?
It's pretty tight.
Yeah.
And just like that's like the right bones, right? And then the guy's like, oh yeah, and the motor's been rebuilt. Here's the dyno graph, and mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, there's no one to race in Oklahoma. I'm just getting out of it. He wanted to get rid of everything. It was, you know, at the right time of year. It was end of the season. You knew he was going to have to sit on it for 6 months. So he's like, okay. We talked about it on the drive home. When we left here, we didn't think we were getting a car. Mm-hmm. We were just checking them out, seeing the stories. But by the time we got back to Columbus, an hour away, like, you know, we should probably talk to that guy and see if we can actually work down a number for that car.
Mm-hmm.
And we had him go run a fresh dyno just to make sure the motor was still good. And that's the car we ended up buying. Yeah. Ended up meeting him later, like in Kansas City or somewhere halfway between here and Oklahoma. And that became the car that the three of us raced the next year. And for a couple of years, it was three of us splitting events. Mm-hmm. We used to drive in PT and Speccy 30 in the same weekend. You know, two guys would do one weekend, two guys would do the next weekend.
The car held up pretty good or something like that?
That car is still on the same motor.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
Some refreshes?
No, nothing.
No refresh?
Nothing. Wow. Spark plugs.
And that's it?
That's it.
Oil change, spark plugs, whatever.
Oil change and spark plugs.
It's still making the same power?
It's within 2 horsepower of what it was when we bought it.
That's just day that's and ridiculous. How straight it is on the dyno. Holy cow. That's nuts.
And it's frequently on the podium, so it's been on the dyno a lot. Yeah. I get dynoed multiple times per year. Cool. So the car is just consistent as can be. It's been great.
Wow. Has that class changed much or no?
It has in different areas of the country.
Yeah.
There's been some areas where some bigger money's come in.
Okay.
And you got some guys spending NorCal and Southeast.
Yeah.
There's some money in Southeast as well. And you've got guys buying, you know, cars that are basically, I don't want to say pro built, but shop built. So, you know, you can build one of those cars for as little as $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Our car came with a list of receipts and an itemized list, and it was $22,000 without the donor car.
Hmm. A lot of money.
So, you know, depends on how you do it.
You could probably spend a lot more than that, too.
You know, we bought it for half that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the way things work. And you don't ever want to try and get your money out of a race car.
Not really, no.
Because it's just not going to happen.
Unless you did every ounce of labor and then you ain't get paid for that labor.
I always say it's the best to buy a used car if you can. But I see you shaking your hand. Yeah. That's exactly what you have to really do your due diligence.
And you got
to
know that car. Sure. And you got to know the owner.
Yes.
And
I know a lot of people that have turned down like what looks like a good deal on a race car just due to the cage.
Yes.
And the cage, if the cage isn't very good.
And that was the thing why we bought this car, too. It's like, you know, even if we have to do anything else, we know we don't have to do the cage. The cage is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And McMahon, I've been in probably a half dozen cars that he's done cages on. And I can't imagine going anywhere else for a cage. I mean, I can see why people tow halfway across the country.
Yeah, that's a long way from Oklahoma.
It is. Yep. Wow. But he is the man when it comes to cages.
Well, if he's $1,000 cheaper than everybody else, too, it's a lot of fuel.
It is.
Yeah, it's a lot of fuel. It pays for a lot of gas time.
Yeah.
Yep. Back then, he was still MIG welding.
Yeah.
I think he does TIG now, but...
nothing wrong with MIG if you do it right.
But you couldn't tell.
Is that good?
Really?
You look at the cage in our
barely
car,
any splatter.
It's MIG welded. Yeah. It's MIG welded, and you would swear it's a TIG car.
That's cool.
And it was MIG welded.
Wow.
It's so small and so tight.
Yeah.
You'd appreciate it. I know you
would. That's cool, man.
From a fabrication standpoint.
How long has he been doing cages for? Any idea?
I have no idea.
If you got that website, longer than
you look at some pictures on there. There's some pictures probably back in the 80s, but he's certainly been doing as long as I've been racing because I knew him from the very beginning.
I really like building cages. I don't know if I could do it for a living, but it's fun to do once you got your head into, you know, what you want the final outcome to be. A lot of people just kind of start, you know, I'm going to just buy that cage kit and I'll put it in. And then this is what I did. I cut my first cage out again and I put it in a Chop Top Challenge car. Then I put another one in and now I'm going to cut that one out and start over again. you learn a lot if you just read all the threads online and look at a lot of roll cages and talk to people about theory. And a dude like that is the guy to talk to.
So I actually met Jeremy from Roll Cage Stuff because Jason Kohler had caged his S2000.
Oh, that's right.
And
I did
we
the
were
tech
here
inspection
in
on
April
it, maybe?
One year. Yeah. And you did the, you know, the annual
inspection
the annual for
tech.
Him. Yep.
Okay.
So
I've been doing that for probably about 5-6 years as well for NASA. You know, there aren't a lot of shops in this area that do it.
Yeah.
And the ones that do, they're typically only open like 9 to 5.
Yep.
And if you have a race car, that's kind of hard to get to. So
day off of work.
Yeah, exactly. People, you know, like come to me cause I'll do it in the evenings or the weekends.
Yeah.
Or sometimes I even do house calls. If
doesn't
NASA
charge $100 at an event now?
They do. Yeah. It used to be 50 and now it's 100.
Yeah.
And they just, I mean, it's pretty intrusive to have a car come in and need a full thing. Plus, they really don't want you to find out at the event that you've already paid for.
It makes some sense.
That your car is not legal.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I find stuff all the time. Even stuff like guys will like have a logbook full of stuff and you look, inspect the cage and you're like, dude, sorry, I can't sign off on this car.
Yeah. Interesting.
See, I screwed up in 2012 at Nationals because I was running TT. And for regional TT stuff in the Midwest, they were letting you do HPD tech each event.
Yep.
So that's what I was doing. And I rolled up here like the day of the event and, you know, started getting ready and rolled up and the guy was like, where's your annual? You know, where's your annual? You need an annual tech to go you know, for nationals. Mm-hmm. So at that time, I think I had like $400 in my bank account. Had to spend 100 of it on an annual test for that weekend.
A TT car?
Yeah.
Those things could be stock street cars.
And the thing that sucked was that there were no more regional events. So I paid $100 to tech it for that event.
One time.
And then that was it.
One time use.
Yeah. So kind of sucked. But
I love how that kind of stuff is where, you know, like, say you've not been running SCCA and you need to go run the VIR 13-hour and you need to get a license or, you know, a membership or something. And you're basically buying it for one time. So luckily, sometimes SCCA will do stuff where you can get a weekend membership, and that's really nice. But not a lot of organizations had that.
No. I basically bought a NASA license for the one NASA race I ran in 2015.
That was the only time.
I raced one last year, and now I got to figure out how to get it again.
Yep.
But I don't think it'll be very hard, but...
But, you know, after racing this long, somewhere about there in the middle of that, I kind of got to this plateau where I was like, I wasn't really getting any faster. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I was still racing a lot, but just didn't seem like anything was changing. And that's what first got me into data acquisition.
Okay.
I started looking for trying to figure out how to go faster, what I was doing. And once I started using data, I realized that even when I would get the same lap time, I wasn't necessarily doing it the same way.
Okay.
And so when you could start to look at the data, you're using an AIM Solo now, you know, you can look and you can see what you're doing in the corners and you find you're not doing the stuff the same way and you start putting those pieces together and going faster. And at first it just kind of started off as a, you know, a personal journey to try and improve. And then I started helping other people and, you know, it eventually turned into a business of selling equipment as well as doing coaching and doing all that kind
of
stuff.
Okay. So you do a lot of coaching or no?
I do coaching. I've done coaching, you know, for Grand Am teams. I've done coaching for, you know, just... you know, guys that are even not even racing yet.
Yeah.
Typically, though, from a data standpoint, the data coaching typically works best with people that are getting either very close to racing or racing.
Okay.
Because that's the point at which you can't really be that useful in the right seat of the car. Mm-hmm. You know, once you get to a driver at a certain level, being in the right seat, you just don't get the same feelings.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have the inputs on the wheel, so like it feels a little different in the passenger seat. So it's kind of like only I feel like there's only so far you can go.
And those are the guys looking for like a second or two instead of like
six.
Seven.
Right? Yeah, it's really easy when it's, you know, 6 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the point at which data becomes really appropriate, and you start getting a lot of benefit from it. And so, you know, guys, very fast HPD guys, or guys, you know, transitioning to racing, or guys that are racing, and I found that I'm an engineer, so. It's easy for me to look at graphs and go over that kind of stuff. And I found that that's not universal. And I was like, weird.
Yeah. No,
not everybody's an engineer. Go figure.
That's making sense of squiggly lines.
That's not
the brain I have. Like, I have a brain of, like, let's take it apart and fix it. But, like, I don't have a brain of open the computer.
Right.
Like,
and so I found a lot of people like that needed...
I need to pay you some money sometime to do that.
just needed some help in terms of understanding what they got. Because there was a lot of people running around with, you know, $1,000 lap timers.
Yeah.
Right, and they just
$1,000 stopwatch.
Yeah, they weren't making use of what they had, and it's really a big step up for them to begin to learn that. And it's so rewarding to work with somebody like that. And just it's like, kind of like back when you start instructing, you're working with beginners, and you kind of you can see the light bulb go off.
Yeah,
right?
The first couple of years, it's so rewarding.
Yeah, it's a whole other world when people start to realize what's there and really dig into what it. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, I love being around the track and racing. So when I'm not on track myself, it's a great way to be at the track and help other people get faster.
Is that is it like a big part of your day to day work? Is the fast tech stuff?
I wouldn't say it's a big
Seems
part.
Like
of,
it's a pretty big side job. Like
it is a pretty big
a lot of
side
people
job.
Know about it,
but it depends. It kind of goes in waves. There's certain times of the year that are busier than others, and then it also depends on the year in terms of if I have a. Some just a bunch of one-off jobs, or whether it's like a you know plan for the entire year. I've had seasons where there's no, you know, multiple event plans. Mm-hmm. I've had seasons where you know I've had to split them with Greg because there was too many. Right?
Okay.
We had to go when we were doing the Grand Am stuff. Right? He did half the events. I did half the events.
Yeah, you can't be gone every weekend.
Yeah, because you only have so much time off to be able to go and do these types of things. Because trying to do that as a full-time gig is that's a tough sell. You got to be Ross Bentley.
Yeah, there's not many of them.
So there's probably, you know, one handful of people that, you know, do that kind of stuff that you know names of. Now, there's another group of guys that do it that you never hear about because they only do pro team stuff and they're not really in the public eye at all.
Yep.
They don't publish books. They don't do that kind of stuff. But there are guys out there that do that kind of stuff. But they've got pretty consistent gigs with pro
teams.
They're
probably booked. Yeah.
I know a couple of the, like, the factory race teams, like, employ somebody full-time as their full-time job as a data analyst.
Yep. And, you know, it's an important thing, especially...
Especially nowadays with the technology being well, accessible.
Yeah. CAN is huge. Yeah. CAN is the you know, the latest and greatest, and there's so much stuff that's over available with CAN where you can hook up two wires and get 30 channels of information. You know, they used to be 30 sensors each, you know, $100 to $500 each.
Yeah, 60 wires.
That, you know, that kind of level of data that you can get now with, you know, an AIM solo DL and two wires used to be, you
Those
know...
Are only two wires?
For CAN.
For CAN, yeah. And then for the OBD2 cars that still, you know, use OBD2, like my FRS, tons and tons of channels of data coming through there.
Well, because the stuff you're talking about, like with the AIM Solo DL, it only works with OBD2 CAN.
Mm-hmm.
So it is still using CAN. Some cars, a lot of Porsches, for some reason, they have a different level of data available at the CAN port than they do if you actually take the two wires and tap into it.
Okay.
So some cars, you can just get all the information at the OBD2 port.
Some you can't. Yeah.
Some you can't. Yeah. And then, of course, the old school cars like yours, you got to run a sensor for everything you want to do.
Yeah, 60 but wires.
It's surprising, you know, even just a simple AIM Solo, you know, it's all GPS, it's all built in. It's amazing what you can get out of that.
I love how simple it is. You just suction cup it to the window. You,
throw it in your buddy's car for the next session.
Yeah, exactly.
Throw it in somebody else's car.
That, to me, that's the coolest part about it, is I could take it and toss it into Mike Taylor's car when I raced it.
Actually,
and toss
I had
it in
a
my brother's car.
And I had a Trackmate that I used for you know, for probably two seasons, and then when I found out the AIM Solo existed, I was like, oh, that was awesome, because I had like three cars I was tracking at that time, and it was a pain to move everything in and out each time.
Yep. You had a lot of cars you were beating up one time.
Yeah,
I would definitely say that the AIM Solo has really opened up data acquisition to a whole new group of people.
Yeah,
and a lot of the organizations are using it to do a little bit of balanced performance and
stuff. When I was running NASA, I got one stuck in my car like two or three sessions.
Yeah, we use it in SEC.
I've had them in my cars as well.
Yeah,
especially at nationals.
And they're magnetic; you can just pop them right on the floor.
Yep,
I've not seen that done too much. Yeah, people think that as long as it's reading, you know, yes, technically that's true, but there is also different levels of GPS signal quality. So depending on what you're trying to get out of it, it does sometimes pay attention to, you know, the signal strength in terms of what you're getting, because you can get a better quality signal trace.
I know you can calibrate it too based on like how it's oriented when you're mounting it and stuff like that. There's a lot of small setup stuff that, you know, you can really get into.
But, you know, there's a bunch of
nerds.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's a lot of different data acquisition companies, and each of them have strong suits. So I've worked with a lot of them, and, you know, continue to work with a lot of them. And each company has areas where they have, you know, their strong suit. So some people are very influenced by video.
Yeah.
Right? They want a video system. So there's systems that are kind of more video with data as opposed to data with video, where like video is the prime component. You know, you can do that with a RaceKeeper system. You can do that with a AIM Solo and a, you know, SmartyCam. And you can do it with a Race Technology Video 4. You can put four cameras on it. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do stuff. But so that's why I think, you know, I have a website, of course, but I don't do online ordering because everybody's case is different.
Yeah.
And people don't really know what they need necessarily. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they do, right? But a lot of times, after talking to them, you steer them in a different direction because, hey, you know, that's not really, you think you want that because someone so and so told you that, but really this would be better for you in your case or your car because this company has all the CAN codes for your car.
Okay.
Right? This company doesn't. If you go with this company, you have to wire a bunch of sensors yourself. You go with this company, you get 30 channels of information for free.
Yeah, when I wanted to buy an AIM Solo from him, he calls me up. I'm like, I just want to send you money, man. He wanted to make sure it was the right thing for me.
That's right.
That's probably a good way to run a side business, is try to provide the best product for something.
Well,
it's the best way.
Away from the track, I wouldn't call myself a people person.
Yeah.
But when I'm at the track, I'm kind of a people person.
Okay.
Because track people are different. They're not the general consumer, right? I have not a lot of patience for the general consumer. But track people are kind of different people. They're kind of my people.
Yep.
And so I like helping people. And, you know, that, you know, I help you with the data system, and then, you know, a month down the road, hey, I need this for my race car. Do you have this race car? I can get it. So, you know, it started with data acquisition and kind of blossomed into other things, you know, track prep stuff, whether it's, you know, race belts, race seats, helmets, brake pads, you know, stuff that people need for taking their cars to the track. Yeah. And people like to work with somebody they know somebody they trust, somebody to give them a recommendation, someone who's tried a lot of different things. And that's a, you know, a valuable viewpoint to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's kind of where we are with HPDE people. Like, what do we do with this? And it's like, I don't know. Let's ask a racer friend. You got to have that hierarchy of knowledge.
Yeah.
You
know?
Just this week, I had a conference call with the a couple of chapters here in the Ohio PCA, and they are starting to talk about how to bring data acquisition into their DE program. So there's two events this year, one in May and one in June. We're working with AIM. AIM's going to help supply some of those same solos that they use for the compliance at the NASA events. They're going to bring those to the PCA event.
Oh, cool.
Which is kind of a, you know, a new and different thing for PCA. So we're going to try and do a couple things and see how it works using solos in students' cars.
Okay.
And in advanced students, you know, solo students and with the instructors. And the idea there is not to necessarily focus on lap times like you would when you're racing stuff. In fact, we'll probably
mount it
stick
somewhere
the solos
you can't see it
in a non-visible area just to record the data and not focus on lap times, but to focus on looking at individual corners or groups of corners and show them what they're doing. They may not realize what they're doing, and maybe the instructor, when they're still right seating with somebody, can have the data to then back up what they're feeling or showing the students.
Let's try
because
something different here,
some people get overloaded in the car. They start not listening. You can go back afterward and say, here, this is what I was telling you. Here it is in the data. You can see you were doing this. You were letting off and coasting or whatever it is. But again, it's got to be for the right type of student. It's not something that's, I think, applicable for everybody.
Right.
But it'll be interesting to explore that because that's kind of a new thing. You don't really see any clubs using data acquisition for normal HPDE.
Yeah, now it's becoming a little bit more accessible, so that's plus.
It is, you know, with a solo being $400.
Yeah.
It's hard. If you do this kind of stuff on any regular basis, it's hard to not justify.
It's one of the best investments that you can really make.
It is the gateway drug.
Yeah.
All right. All right.